Okay, thank you. So I had the choice. I, when invited to give this colloquium, I could have talked about physics, but I decided in the spirit of the colloquium that I would search for this sweet spot between cultural enlightenment and entertainment. And so that's what I'm aiming for here. This talk has the additional virtue that I already had slides available. So that's roughly the outline. I'll get to a little bit. Focus of the talk will be using physicist methods to do some of the text analysis and other things that you're familiar with, but that you're not as familiar with. But I'll start out with a brief overview. Not all of you are familiar with this standard sort of historical introduction to the archive. This is the not the current screen grab of the front page. This is the resource I'll be using as my data set. It's a screen grab from about 10 years ago. It bears a striking resemblance to the current one. It's not exactly the same. And when I describe this, I usually describe it in glass half full and glass half empty terms. The glass half full is, you know, what amazing prescience to have designed this interface and underlying software that didn't have to be changed for 20 years. And the glass half empty, of course, is, oh my God, does that ever need an overhaul? So we're somewhere in between those two points of view. Just the, from the overhaul historical standpoint, this thing started summer of 1991. There are potentially some people here in this audience who were, you know, around at its inception. But it gives one pause when I look at this and do the sort of calculation that the current undergraduate class entering Cornell this fall is presumably born in this range around 1997, if they're entering at age 18. And so we're now dealing with people who have been using Google since the age of two, roughly. And it gives a different perception, whereas there are people here who remember not only what life was like before Google, but what life was like before the internet. In fact, there are only one or two of us here who remember what it was like even before email. But I will point out that I wasn't planning to say this, but it just sprung into mind. The very first article ever that had email addresses on it in any field was an article that I wrote with Jeff Harvey, and that was his idea to put the email addresses on it. So that was possibly his greatest contribution to science. But I'll get to some of your other contributions. Okay, so what are some of the other prime historical notes here? Well, it started in August 1991. It was originally some subset of physics. It was just intended for the subgroup of people in high energy particle physics working on these random matrix models of two-dimensional gravity, and quickly expanded. Just to give an indication, it started just as email. This was before the World Wide Web, so it was an automated email transponder. And, you know, just to give a couple of indications that it wasn't perhaps as entirely trivial as it sounds, I have an email from this era. We started up the web interface in the 1992-1993 timeframe. And in 1994, I have an email from somebody from the American Physical Society. They were thinking of putting their resources online. And I recommended, well, just do it the way we're doing it. We have this web interface, and at the time, this was before PDF, but you could download compressed PostScript, and said, you know, just put the stuff up on a web interface, and you'll be all set. And I treasure this email. The response from this subcommittee of their publications oversight committee was that learning to install and operate a web browser is very difficult, and we can't really expect that of the ordinary physicist. So, so they went a different route, and took them a few years to recover from that. So you see that you know, there's this roughly linear growth rate in the number of submissions to the point where, and I'll get back to this in a moment, it went over a million a few months ago, total accumulated submissions. This linear growth rate is a little hard to model because it's some confluence of exponential adoption rates from different communities that then, you know, go up fast and then saturate, and somehow it's maintained this roughly effectively linear growth over a couple of decades. So this is just, I'm not going to dwell on this a lot. It's currently growing at about 100,000 new submissions per year. So we estimate, about 1.1 million end of 2015 at current growth rates, you know, closing in on 2 million 6 or 7 years from now. I did want to say one thing. This is something of a digression, but it fascinated me at the time and ties into something I'll say a little more about, just about the regularity of some of these stochastic effects. In the run-up to the 1 million, of course, at Cornell, it's a big deal. You get, it's always good to get the external publicity. And so the library, which currently runs this, tried to figure out roughly when that would happen. So at the end of November, I did this projection. And what we're seeing here is, I guess, the blue, the red are the submissions from the same dates translated by one, because 365 is 1 mod 7. And the Monday through Friday cycle is significant here because Monday includes the weekend. And so that's always these large number of submissions. So at the end of November, I tried to project roughly when it would go through 1 million. And my projection came out to be the night of Christmas Day, sometime on the night of 25th of December. So that was a little awkward because not everybody's on, but it was useful information to have. And the way I did this projection was the simplest imaginable thing. I just took the previous years, added an inflation factor. I mean, it was roughly 7%, I think, overall in 2014 over 2013. Did that projection, and then the amazing thing was just kept tracking it in real time as we went through December. And this projection done a month before hit when it went through the million point within about 15 minutes that night. There's some amount of luck there, but even so, there's something, an amazing fact that lots of probability distributions become Poissonian, and it's a similar fact when you get to the big data, and you don't have to work hard to tease the signal out. And I'll get back to that phenomenon in a bit. And then, it did work from their standpoint. We got really nice coverage. It's nice to know that not just Nature, but various other popular presses in various languages were keeping track of this even over the Christmas, New Year's break. So one other comment just about the distribution. Here it is broken down by major subject area just to see what the most significant trends have been over the last 20 plus years. And again, a slight historical comment that's easy to make. One of our colleagues, right in this same 1994 timeframe, I'll even tell you who it was, Michael Turner, pointed to this when it was dominated by the high energy physics was still there. And he said, that's all well and good for the particle theorists who are only interested in results of the last 10 or 20 nanoseconds, but this will never catch on in a serious subject like astrophysics. And, of course, within 10 years, you see the red, which is astrophysics, and the green, which is condensed matter, just because of the number of people in these subject areas it came to dominate. And those aren't even the major growth areas. It's the primary reason for showing this is just to see this dramatic growth in something we might not even have expected, say in mathematics, and then finally starting up in computer science. And the main lesson I'm presenting this in order to convey is that when communities adopt this, for those of us in high energy physics, it was not even, it was just a minor evolution to go from what we were already doing with preprints to move over to doing it electronically via resource, but there are other fields in here that didn't have that pre-existing habit. Once they adopted it, there's some kind of ratchet mechanism they lock in. And so, you know, by that basis, you would expect this kind of growth just to continue indefinitely. And computer science is finally starting to pick it up as well. Now, there's a, you know, 20 years ago, some of this was actually cutting edge. You know, the, some of the things that we implemented, like linking the author names to search indices, having this abstract page as a hub, none of it terribly deep or profound. But, you know, this is a lesson for doing research, too. If you're in there on the ground floor, anything you do is new and innovative. And, you know, foreshadowing Web 2.0 in the sense that here's some skeletal service where all of the content is provided by users. Now, there's a gigantic story here that I'm going to leave out entirely because it's not as much fun to talk about here, which is just where this fits in the overall sociology of scholarly publishing and open access and financial models. And I'm going to skip all of that. I'll be here for the rest of the week, so anybody who's interested in talking about that can find me in room 223, which I found by tapping on one of these touch-sensitive maps that are up all over the floors. So all of that works. There are a few surprises. I won't say anything here other than, you know, what I just mentioned about scholarly publishing as a whole, still in transition. We don't know what the final model is going to be. One surprise is, you know, that we're still using tech. This is a surprise because tech we adopted in the early 1980s, and it was intended not for what we're using it for, which is a network transmission format. It was Knuth's encyclopedic demolition of the problem of print on paper. And we're really feeling, you know, some of the detriments of having adopted that, because there are lots of semantic things that you just can't do in tech, and so it's becoming more of a ball and chain than ever, but there isn't something right now like tech that is advantageous in every way over what preceded it. In the case of tech, it was, you know, the advantage was we not only got a better output, we no longer had to, you know, go through the literal cut and pasting with a secretary and a typing pool. Another, you know, what I would call a surprise, if you're just thinking more generally, is that having grown up in the 1960s and watching commercial television where the funding model was that the content would grab eyeballs and then the networks were selling eyeball time to the advertisers, and it's kind of ironic that 50 years later, this is the financial model for all of the resources we're using, just this, you know, pushing things in your face, and I don't necessarily regard that as positive. But what I primarily want to talk about here, 15 minutes in, is thinking about text as a computable object and thinking about some statistical mechanical features of these textual objects. We've had this million articles and counting, and it keeps growing. And so I wanted to introduce you to a variety of things we're doing with them and why we're doing it. You know, some of it gets into these conceptual issues when you're maintaining a resource like archive and you're trying to make it as useful as possible to researchers. That was the original intent, part of why I showed the history there was to indicate when this thing was conceived in the early 1990s, we didn't have to worry about the general public because it was only the academic community that was online. And now there's much more pressure that I'll get to towards the end. Everybody is online, and so in order to reconstruct in some virtual way the sort of ivory tower we had back then, requires increasing amounts of automation behind the scenes. And so some of that I'll get to very quickly. Now, the basic methodology that I'll be using is something I can say I teach in an undergraduate course in, I teach an intro to data science course at Cornell, which is intended for I guess, sophomore level. And one of the prime methodologies that's used and used more generally on the internet is something called naive Bayes. Bayes theorem may or may not be familiar to you. I'm using it in the following form. This is the probability of having some property given some feature. So you could think of C as, you know, say one of the archive categories, and W is some word that appears in a document. And Bayes' theorem just allows you to take a conditional probability like this, the probability that that an object has that property, given that it has that feature. You can write in terms of the probability that it has the feature given the property times these normalization factors. And the naive Bayes is just assuming that all of the features are statistically independent. So you can write the probability of a document having a given set of words, given that it's in this category, as the product of all of those individual probabilities. And that assumption, of course, is, you know, there are going to be statistical correlations between the words, but overall, they're weak enough that this gives a very good approximation to the kind of things you're interested in. So where is this used? This is, you know, most significantly used in all of your experience, even though it's behind the scenes, starting over a decade ago in spam filters. These spam filters were automatically including the words that were used in the text, figured out which ones were statistically correlated with spam. There were words like offer and and even HTML snippets like FF0000, which turns out to code for red, which turned out to be significant in a lot of these spam things. We're using it for text classification. It's used for spell correction. Peter Norvig from Google has a wonderful series of blog posts that I use in my teaching explaining how this formula, the interpretation of the objects here just changes. Then it's the probability that you meant this word, given that you typed this word, in terms of the error model, the probability that you typed a word, given that you meant this word, times the probability of what you meant. That's the language model. And in that case, it's playing off this error model times the language model. You know, you're more likely to have typed a word that occurs more often in the language, but it's discounted by the likelihood of making that error. Voice recognition, Siri, Android, also very similar methodology, the probability that you meant to say this word given some set of phonemes is, again, this is the error model for the acoustic identification, and you use the same language model. Or actually, you use a language model adapted to the task if you're working on a mobile phone. Most people, you know, the language probabilities are distortion because a lot of times the thing you're asking about is how to get somewhere. And that affects what you say. It's also used for Google Translate. And the one of the take-homes from this that I'd like you to get from this slide is that in this big data realm, the lesson we teach people is the more data you have, the simpler the algorithms can be. These more sophisticated algorithms tend to overfit on small amounts of data. Not only perform slower on the large data, they don't even perform as well. And so each time you scale up an order of magnitude in data, you can use simpler algorithms. And it's, again, along the lines that I mentioned before. You think about statistically, when you have lots and lots of data, your signal is much easier to tease out, and you don't have to be that sophisticated. And we'll find that these simple methodologies tend to work incredibly well. So in this regard, I wanted to give you a first broad overview of the kind of thing I'm thinking about. This is a map of the language models for the 142 different subject areas of the archive. And what am I plotting here? I'm plotting what's known in computer science as the Kullback-Leibler divergence. In physics, it would just be called the cross-entropy. If you have two probability distributions, you know, PI, where I indexes the objects, and QI, it looks like something like the sum of PI log PI over QI. That's the usual definition of the cross entropy. And notice it's asymmetric. What does it mean, quote unquote, physically? Well, that's easy to intuit by, you know, looking at this feature here. This horizontal line is on happy X, high energy experimental physics. And so the horizontal is telling you the probability of drawing a high energy physics article out of the things labeled on the vertical. And the fact that this is cold, meaning it's difficult, is an indication that high energy physics experiment just uses this very specific vocabulary that's hard to draw from anywhere else, a vocabulary of names of detectors, experimental apparatus, and even places where these detectors occur. And you know, the ones that are on the vertical are usually ones that are really small, and so it's hard to have a high probability of drawing anything. And the feature on this, these things are ordered alphabetically along the diagonal. The feature is there's enormous signal in this. This upper left here are the astrophysics categories and the condensed matter categories. The sparse region is computer science, and then over here is math. And there's enormous statistical regularity in this. I first wrote this thing not only for fun and for a class demo, but for purely practical reasons. We had these issues of, for example, somebody intending to submit to general relativity would submit instead to lattice gauge theory, HEP-LAT. Can anyone imagine why that would possibly occur? Yeah. The ringer in the front pointed out that they're next to each other in that pull-down menu. So if you have a one-off error and you're aiming for GRQC, some percentage of the time you'll hit HEP-LAT and vice versa. And these things are very easy to distinguish. And I just wanted, for fun, to see automatically if I could get that. And it worked spectacularly successfully. It went through a few iterations. At some point, you know, I realized one of the key features that improved it was by figuring out when to combine words, because you know, the paradigmatic example would be a genetic algorithm, where genetic means biology, except if it's followed by algorithm, in which case it never means biology. It means, you know, neural evolutionary computing. And so whole, you know, means something different if it's preceded by black rather than electron positron. So by taking advantage of that bigram thing, I suddenly got something that was, you know, better than 95% accurate. And I have to mention in this context, going back to this guarding the perimeter, that every once in a while I would notice that it would spit out something as unclassifiable. And if you would look at it, that would almost invariably turn out to be, you know, some nonsensical non-science that we didn't want anyway. And you know, the funny thing is, all I wanted something was something that, you know, could distinguish our 142 subject classes. And by complete accident, I had constructed the Holy Grail crackpot filter. But then, if you think about it, it's not that surprising. You know, why does that work? How do we learn to write the way we lurk? How do we learn to write the way we do? Well, we go through undergraduate training, we go through graduate training, many years of postdoc training. We learn a lot about how to write in a particular style, and that's very much embedded in the probability distributions of the words that we use. And the people who haven't gone through that training, you know, just haven't experienced that. And it's very difficult to emulate it. And I'm always asked, you know, you know, what if they could learn to start simulating it? And I'm always reminded, this might not mean anything to most of you, but there was, you know, one of these many Star Trek episodes with a transporter failure. And, you know, the good guys ended up in this world of barbarians. But they fit right in, whereas the barbarians, you know, were instantly put in the brig, because, you know, it just is the case that it's easier for civilized people to emulate barbarians and vice versa. Okay, here's just a blow up of the same thing, just to again give a little more intuition. Hard for even me to see here what I was looking for, but here's GRQC and the HEPs, and so here's HEPTH, which you can see has much more in common with mathematical physics and virtually nothing in common with high energy experiment. So these things show up. Okay. Let me just thread in an anecdote since I have this slide, and I will come back to this right at the end or possibly 10 minutes after the end. I was asked, so this is related, this is the same author who wrote one of those, that Nature article about the 1 million. And a few weeks later, this is still of sociological interest to all of us here. A few weeks later, he wrote to me saying, say, there's a UK research assessment exercise about to come out. Some of you have probably participated in these. We're all, not just in science, but in 36 different subject areas, and those labeled the vertical here, have to write up some short summary of their external impact. And so there were about 9,000 PDF articles of these things, and he wrote to me and asked, you know, he said he wanted to write something about this, but, you know, they can't even get the text in order to mine. All it is in the form of these PDFs, and so it seems completely cumbersome, and is there any way of even downloading and processing that many things? And my answer, of course, was, 9,000 PDFs is nothing. That's the kind of thing we, ingest, translate, and mine on a daily basis without even exercising any of our machines. And so I said, look, sure, I think I can do what you're thinking of doing on a, basically a one-hour turnaround. What he wanted to do was see whether there were any words that were correlated with the scores. So each one of these research assessment exercises was given a score by an external panel to find out whether there are words that tended to score particularly high or low. And, I did this, I've moved over to using IPython notebooks, and I suppose this is the kind of thing I would give as an assignment. It's a simple linear regression. You find out which words are positively, negatively correlated with the scores. You make sure it's statistically significant, and you're not doing any selection errors. And I suppose my students would be heartened to know that I actually can do this as quickly as I claim they should be able to do their problem sets. And the results were quite fun, and this gives pause. Now remember the usual caveat, this is correlation, not causation. They're different. What are the words that score the lowest, that are most negatively correlated with score? Well, if you can't read it, I'll tell you. The one at the bottom is research. And I didn't feed this in. University, student, academic, and the ones that do very well are hard to read. Can I read them from over here? Oh, I can. Government, committee, report, millions. So. So it was an interesting outcome. Now, I'll get back, remember this, because there was something about this. So they used my actual data for this, but it appeared a week late for reasons I'll get to towards the end if I have time. There was a fun story there. Now, I want to take a digression since I'm on this subject of textual analysis to tell you a story that's quite fun, but still in some ways affects us, and especially since there's a follow-up to this just from a few weeks ago that I'll get to. So There was a news story about a year ago about publishers having to withdraw a bunch of articles that were computer-generated nonsense, and publishers like Springer and IEEE. And in order to explain this, I have to tell you about something that was written almost 10 years ago by some computer scientists at MIT, computer science graduate students at MIT. It's called SciGen. So what was the problem they were trying to solve? They had this annoyance that they kept receiving invitations to submit articles to conferences that they were convinced were faux conferences, that these things were just scams run by the organizers in order to make money out of registration fees, that no real peer review was going on. Now, since they were computer science graduate students at MIT, they decided to write a computer program to generate fake articles, and that's the SciGen. But because of who and where they were particularly inspired. Their computer program created TechSource, put it in the right format, created random tables, random figures, random references, you know, intentionally so that looked at from 20 feet away, it looked like an article, but it was intentionally so that if you actually read the thing, it would be obvious nonsense. It was based on something known as a probabilistic context-free grammar. Those of you who've played, there's a little book that was around when I was young called Mad Libs, and it's just like this, you know, it's a skeletal text where you substitute in nouns and verbs in the right places. So in order to demonstrate this, sitting quickly in my office just before, I went to the site, plugged in some randomly chosen names, and saw what it would generate. So okay. So you get this sort of idea, you know, we emphasize that we allow wide area networks to visualize highly available algorithms without the investigation of it. You know, it's so I allege with complete confidence that this is not only better than any article these three authors have ever written together, but any that they ever would have written together. Okay, so, all right, there are a bunch of mysteries here. First of all, why in the world would anybody be using articles that were intentionally supposed to be nonsense in order to pad their CVs, which appeared to be happening? That is not a question I will be able to answer. But what I will say is the same fellow who pointed this out, a computer scientist at Grenoble called Cyril Labbé, that I've been in contact with, had previously done something else that was sort of inspired, which is he took the SciGen and he modified it so that it would create articles, each of which had 100 references. And he created 100 such articles, each one of which had one mainstream references and 99 references to the other 99. And put them up so that they would be ingested by Google Scholar. Does anyone know what the H index under those circumstances would be? Does anyone know what the definition of H index is? The largest N such that N articles have N citations. Sorry? Well, there are 100 articles, each one of which has 99 citations to the other 99. What's the H index? I'll give you a hint. The answer appears twice in that description. Anyone? Wow, this is quite annoying. 99, somebody said. is the right answer. When he did that and Google Scholar ingested it, it was only 94, which he attributed to experimental error. But you know, the reason you put the one mainstream reference in is because Google Scholar at the time was configured that it would always, you needed at least one mainstream reference, but that was sufficient. And the outcome of this was that this fictitious person, Ike Ankhtari, whom he called one of the great stars in the scientific firmament, became the computer scientist with the highest H index instantaneously. And Google Scholar has since changed its methodology as a result of this. But so I became intrigued, of course, because the one way of thinking about this is it's all like quantum mechanics. Anything that can happen will happen. And so, you know, if this is out there, then these things might be coming to archive. And I had a very simple way of doing this, and I will just give a 2-minute synopsis of a talk I gave a couple of years ago. You know, this was a full talk where I went in full detail on this methodology, but I'm mentioning just to tell you why I had the right software up to do this instantaneously. For John Preskill's 60th birthday 2 years ago, I had to come up with something that was appropriate to the subject. And it happened that I had just heard on Slate's Lexicon Valley a description of what was, you know, a seeming controversy at the time, which was who wrote the 15th Book of Oz. Now, many of you probably don't know that there was more than one book, if that, if you only know about the movie. But the series of Oz books was like the Harry Potter of its time. In the early 20th century, every year around Christmas, people waited for this new book. And the original author, L. Frank Baum, eventually died. There was a transition book written by two authors. The second was a children's book author by the name of Elizabeth Plumley Thompson. And the question was whether she had entirely written this book, and putting both names on was a cynical ploy on the part of the publisher in order to introduce the author. If so, it succeeded because she went on to write 18 more books right up through 1939 when the movie came out. And as they describe it, I'll just tell you in words what I heard and, you know, why, having taught information retrieval courses at Cornell, it resonated with me. They said what you do is you use the so-called, you use the structural words, the words that glue things together, words like the, of, and. Those are important because those are independent of the plot and give you a direct feeling for the style of these things. And then you use some mathematical technique which allows you to plot blocks of text on a two-dimensional diagram. You look at the known attributions of the two authors and they form two separate clusters. And then you look at the unknown book and you see where the points fall in the cluster associated to one author or the other. And you know, it was meant to be just this a very qualitative description for a general audience, but I instantly recognized it as doing principal components analysis on the stop word distribution. The stop word distribution is the terminology and information retrieval for the most common words like the, of, and or. So, you know, I thought that was cool, and I had this excuse to spend some time creating a talk, and for me, the burning question was not going to be who wrote the 15th Book of Oz, but I was going to ask who wrote the 2005 article on topological entanglement entropy co-authored by Preskill and Kateyev. And I knew this was going to be an easy one because one was a native Russian speaker, the other was a native English speaker. And we all know from our experiences dealing with people who write and speak in English coming from a foreign language that they're, you know, Slavic speakers tend not to use the word the because the definite article doesn't exist in many European languages. So this is just to show you the top 50 words that are most often used in their articles. And The most prominent feature here is this so-called zip distribution. This is the quintessential power law, the primordial power law. The fact that, and it's, you know, it's an amazing fact it, that if you plot the rank of words against their frequency, you get to very, very high accuracy over multiple orders of magnitude, a minus one exponent. That is, that this thing will just be a straight line. What we're looking at right now are the deviations from that straight line. And you see the green is one of them, who uses in two, we be four more often. The blue is the other one, who uses words like will, a. As they are by, oh, I see. Yeah, I mean, the order of the words doesn't matter. The way you typically order the words when you're doing it for just a single corpus is you just order, you order them by rank. So you order them so that this thing is monotonically decreasing. And the reason I hesitate, yeah, but what's non-trivial is that it's a power law. When you, that it's a straight line in log log. And the reason I hesitated was the way I ordered these words was not according to either of these authors, but according to their probabilities in the entire corpus. You know, I picked them because of the overall probability distributions and then just pick, and that's why these curves are themselves not monotonically decreasing. Now the you know, the methodology that one then uses here is just singular value decomposition, and I'm not going to say a lot about it except it's, you know, it's used for everything. It's the basis for the recommender system in Apple iTunes Genius. It's the way the Netflix challenge was solved as a recommender system. It's used in microarray data, weather data, stock data. It's, and it's just a simple generalization of ordinary eigenvalue analysis. You take not a square symmetric matrix, but an arbitrary real matrix, and you can write it in the form u v u sigma v transpose. The generalization is these two things don't have to be the same dimension. They're still square and orthogonal, but they're different matrices. And this object is something that are zeros, except for, you know, the diagonal or what constitutes the diagonal as far as you can go. And then, you know, the for the language thing, that's, I call it singular value decomposition when I teach information science. When I teach quantum computing, I call it the Schmidt decomposition because it's the same thing. And you know, this just remember, this was famously implied for the entanglement spectrum, where you decompose the ground state of a system according to separating it into two physical halves. So what was the result of this for, you know, Preskill and Kateyev? Here are Preskill's single-authored articles. Oh, and let me just say what's happening. So what we're looking at is blocks of 5,000 words, and I'm looking at them in this 50-dimensional space. So each 5,000 block of word is a vector in the 50-dimensional space whose components along the 50-word axes is the number of occurrences in that block of text. So this is this giant cloud that's hard to understand. What's the singular value decomposition or the principal components analysis doing for me? You calculate the covariance matrix, that is just all of the, you know, cross correlations, and diagonalize it. And diagonalizing that allows you to find the plane that cuts this thing with the maximum variance. That's what you're interested in. And so if there's a direction that maximally separates them, you can find it by simple eigenvalue analysis. And what it's doing, you know, with respect to this picture I showed here, it's finding some linear combination of these words, you know, positive on the ones that are here, negative on the ones that are down there, and finds that linear combination that maximally separates these two. And the result of it is, these are the, you know, the words that Preskill used in his single-authored stuff. These are the words that Kateyev used in his single-authored stuff. And this 05 article they wrote came out, you know, basically dead center. So that was already fun, you know, despite the members of the audience who said nasty things like, you know, even if it does turn out that Preskill wrote it, all of the ideas might not have been his. And On the other hand, the fun surprise of this thing was, if you looked at the articles that Kresko wrote subsequently, they crossed the line over to the Russian side. And so, you know, I got it wrong. There was, you know, a significant update on this. I later analyzed these things with a student and found it was quite fun. We wrote it up. You can actually use this to do native language identification. You can use the same sort of clustering analysis. We have enough data. We have this sort of unique data set of people who have various native languages who are forced to speak in English. And systematically, the use of prepositions depending on the native language is so firmly imprinted in the brain, it stands through with this clearly identifiable signal, such that the native Japanese speakers are in one cluster, the native Russian speakers, the native French speakers, the native German speakers, you can almost with complete reliability pick them out. The almost is only because every once in a while in their single-authored stuff, if it's lecture notes, they'll pull in stuff that they co-authored with authors of different native languages. And the thing I got wrong about this is there are various levels of variance. And what this was picking up was not that he was moving Russian, but that he was moving in a more mathematical direction. So that as well was sort of interesting. So skip that. Oh, and then here's the important part. So with respect to SciGen. So for fun, in a class I was teaching at the time, I had them do this for 16th, 17th, 18th, 19th century authors, just because all of these texts are readily available in Gutenberg, and you just can pull them down. You know, incidentally, what I did for Kresko and Kateyev, these people who did the Oz analysis had to go buy the old books, do OCR on them, reread them, check them, and that was a multi-month thing where all I had to do was, you know, sit at a desk and all of the texts were readily available and just plug in buttons and, in Python, all of these linear algebra routines are pre-compiled and, you know, already optimized, so they automatically parallelize. It's a fun computing paradigm, and the graphics are also built into the notebooks. And this one is, there are four authors, so you have three distinguishing directions, and it very nicely picks all of them out. This was so that I could say in the talk, John Kresko, you are no William Shakespeare, because he came out somewhere completely different. So I had this plot for doing the 3D thing, and when I read this thing about iCanTari, it was completely natural to just pull up those texts and write a comment to Nature, which I did a year ago, using exactly that same plot that I had used for the Kresko thing, only now plugging in archive submissions for a certain day and SciGen type stuff. And so here's in the exact same plot doing the same thing. What you find out is, not surprisingly, the SciGen is, just a different native language. The use of prepositions and all of that isn't even a zip flaw, isn't even a minus one slope on the power law. So it stands out, and there are a few variants. The blue is the generic SciGen. iCanTari is separated from it slightly because of the 100 references, they all have titles, and so that affected the of and the distributions, and so you can pick that out. This is a variant that somebody made, which is MathGen, that generates random math articles, so it's presumably distorted because if, then, and let, which are actually become technical words in mathematics. FizzGen also exists, and that one is also easily there, and you can see this is a very clear separator for a decision tree. And we've been running it, and sure enough, it instantly put it online, and sure enough, it flags people trying to submit these things. But as far as I can tell, we got lucky, and even before this particular screen was in place, we hadn't been attracting the crazies in this regard quite yet. And so the follow-up is, the reason I reinserted these slides is because, to my surprise, 23rd of March, that's last month sometime, am I ever in trouble. Springer combined with Cyril Labbé at the University of Grenoble and wrote some software that's now automatically detects these articles that were computer generated. And you know, this is a very odd circumstance, because the whole point of these articles, as I described in the first place, was things that were instantly recognizable as nonsense and intended to show that no people were reading them. And so my comment when I was asked about this is, okay, that's, you know, wonderful, we can finally detect the intentional nonsense generated by computers, but what about all of the unintentional nonsense generated by humans? Okay, so I'm gonna, I've got one major fun topic to do that I think I'm gonna do, and then I'm gonna fast forward. I estimate that I started at 3:05, so I estimate that I'm gonna run over slightly the next 10 minutes. But it's very fun. This was gonna be one of the main topics that I was gonna talk about. A recent development in computational linguistics over the last couple of years was to figure out, and it's very important to some of the directions that we're moving in, to map words onto a vector space. It's called a semantic embedding that have the properties that you can solve analogies using vector addition. So here's an example that I'll give as a challenge to all of you. So what we're trying to encode is the kind of syllogism that you had to answer on your SATs going from high school to college. And the question here is, France is to Paris as Italy is to is right. But can you do that using a vector, where you take some vector and some, say, 50 or 100 dimensional space, subtract the vector for France, add the vector for Italy, and get Rome? And so that was the result of some work done at Google and some other places that's called Glove and Word2Vec. And it was established, we built on it, but it was established software. And I'll skip through these just to give you an indication of the kind of, this is looking at this multi-dimensional space. Once you find the vector representation for all these words, just to see how good it is, not only at analogies, but finding similar words. It manages to group together. And what it's using, I won't be mysterious, I'll say a little more about it in a moment. It's just using words that co-occur. I mean, there's so much statistical regularity in the words that co-occur. People always use words that are colors in the same context, so it manages to group them together. It manages to group together words that are like these hedge words. It understands is in the same sector. Technical words, it manages to group together. It manages, slightly less obviously, to group together first names of different languages. What's happening there? It's just the statistical statement that more often than not, people with Chinese first names tend to co-author, people of the same nationality tend to co-author more often than not. So getting back to the syllogism, this is just to whet your appetite. You know, we ran it on the archive and asked it, you know, did a few simple vector addition things, and I'm going to offer them as challenges and then tell you how all of this works. So this one isn't supposed to be hard yet. Okay, the ringer in the front said, oops, orbital angular momentum, which is the right answer. How about this? What? Somebody did say special, and I just wanted to make sure I didn't mishear the person who I'm certain said GR. Okay, I finally heard it. And so I'm not plugging these things in. These things just come out. This is the last one. Yeah, I once had an audience where nobody got it. But yes, I mean, I heard a few people say that. So, you know, what's happening here? Well, these are, you know, these are other things that are in the near vicinity. But, you know, what's really happening, if you want to get a visual picture, is it's managing, when it does the spectre embedding, the words that are used in the vicinity of all of these are statistically regular enough that it puts things in the same sort of disposition that, you know, the tau and s tau, and so that when you just translate all of the particles to the supersymmetric particles, do the and do the vector addition, the one that's closest looks solves the analogy problem. There are other things like physics plus buzzword turns out to be life science that are hard to understand. And I won't go into any detail on this. You can then use these things to segment articles. This is the just an example. This was the Higgs article, I think, by the Atlas collaboration. And, you know, it picks out, the question was, if you just looked at this article, why is such a large bulk of the article names near the ends? And so, you know, based on the fact that there are 2,000 names near the end of the article, you would have guessed it's one of these large experimental collaborations. But you can do better than that, as I'll show in a little bit. So I'm running out of time. I'm going to give you just the briefest overview of how this works, and then give just the briefest introduction to what was going to be roughly the last third of the talk. I did want to put this in some historical context that Maxwell of electrodynamics fame actually talked about analogies in Nature. In 1856, he wrote, now, as in a pun, two truths lie hid under one expression, so in an analogy, one truth is discovered under two expressions. Every question concerning analogies is therefore the reciprocal of a question concerning puns, and the solutions can be transposed by reciprocation. So I thought that was a brilliant way of thinking about the relation between analogy and puns, but also, you know, explains why, to a physics audience, I'm interested in analogies. And so just to briefly give you the flavor of this, what we're taking advantage of is that the words that occur in the vicinity, these conditional probabilities are just by doing number counts. The conditional probability of a word occurring in the vicinity of ice is just the number of times it occurs in some window divided by the number of times that ice occurs. And for most words that are not going to be sensitive to the difference, this ratio is going to be roughly equal to one, whereas for words that actually tell you something about thermodynamic phase, if it's solid, this is going to be a ratio much larger than one. If it's gas, it's going to be much smaller than one and tells you something about the semantics of these words just by the co-occurrence probabilities. Now, in the analogy task, what we wanted to do was translate this analogy into a minimizing some vector equation. And just to give you the flavor, I'll just say, for most words, this ratio, the probability that occurs in the vicinity of these words, if you do the division to try to figure out man is to woman as king is to supposed to come out to be queen, for most words, these ratios are roughly equal because they're independent of the words, whereas gendered words will be positive for both of these if it's a male-gendered word, and it'll be much less than one if it's a female-gendered word. So you can actually, via these co-occurrences, if you're trying to find some vector embedding that respects these things, hope to have a chance of solving the analogy task. So the way it goes is you translate the analogy task into something analytic by looking for the word that minimizes this ratio. This is not computationally equivalent because you're summing over all possible words that occur in the context, so that could already be a summation of a million things. You've got a million word vocabulary, and then you have to search over a million words to find the minimum of it. It's much easier to somehow do this vector representation you do this linear scan, you calculate it once for all, and then you do your vector addition. And the way it works is, I've already, you know, basically said this, so I won't say more, but it uses a feature. What we mean by dimensional reduction is you diagonalize a matrix. If it has a small number of large eigenvalues, you just remove the rest and then multiply back out the O lambda O after you've truncated the matrix, and you get a good approximation to the matrix, and it looks like a multiplication of two smaller dimensional objects. So, the Mij are what's are the is this logarithm. So what we're using is in information theory, there's this object that's known as mutual information, which essentially tells you how much a joint probability distribution differs from independent distributions. You just sum over all the values they take. If this thing factorizes, all of these logs would be one, and you get zero for the mutual information, and this is sort of measuring the extent to which it differs from that. And it's an empirical fact, if you calculate these joint word probability distributions, divide, take the logarithm, you get a low rank matrix that you can factorize in this way. And that low rank matrix is the vector embedding. And then, you know, I can share the slides on this. From the fact that that matrix factorizes, it's a couple of quick lines of algebra to show that this vector minimization problem agrees with that analytic transcription of the analogy problem and why it's so successful for solving that task. But I spent a little much too much time on the earlier material. So I'm going to take 3 minutes over time to just touch on, and this is an example. This is a student I wrote, a paper I wrote with a student that's going to be in some conference this summer that shows how you can segment articles based on this idea. It's sort of a very important way of getting, you know, say paragraph by paragraph relatedness. And it's interesting that if you tile a million document corpus, take each document and split it into 10 or 20 segments, it would look impossible. You might think that you're, you know, looking at some 10 to the 7th by 10 to the 7th or 10 to the 14th element matrix in order to find out the similarities, but there are wonderful algorithms that turn this into a linear rather than a quadratic problem. So it actually is possible to find the paragraph among a million document corpus that's semantically most similar to this paragraph. I can say more about that later, but you can easily imagine this as being the basis of a recommender system. So I'm just going to finish with two quick things. I had a whole section here that I knew I was going to have to excise. I mean, don't worry, I told Daniel in advance because I got grabbed to lunch. I didn't have a chance to winnow the slides. We are doing something else, which is we analyze every incoming document in real time for its overlap with every other document and have been marking, you know, substantial text overlap with other document, optionally by other authors, optionally with or without attribution. And this was an article that came out late last year in PNIS where we saw the geographic distribution of the authors doing this, and I'll be happy to say more about that. I'm going to truncate this to one thing, which was the surprise, because there's a lesson for students here. The surprise is that people plagiarize acknowledgments and theses. Now, I never would have guessed this would occur, and I'll give you two examples of this. You know, here are two independent theses written by different people. The red is the text that coincides, and you see, I take this opportunity to express my decent of gravity to my supervisor for his constant encouragement, blah, blah, blah. Professor so-and-so, head department of mathematics. The only thing that changed is, I guess, the department of mathematics had turned over. So, you know, there's a certain amount of Manchurian candidate stuff in this, or, you know, thesis advisors forcing people to do it. There are lots and lots of examples in this. For the life of me, I can't imagine if you can't be original in your thesis acknowledgments, you know, what else is left. But this is the one that's, you know, the lesson for students, where The guy on the left says, I cannot describe how indebted I am to my wonderful girlfriend Amanda, whose love and encouragement will always motivate me to achieve all that I can. Particularly my peculiar working hours, erratic behavior towards the end could not have been easy to deal with. And here's somebody else who's equally indebted to his wonderful wife Renata, whose love and encouragement, and you know, whose peculiar working hours and erratic behavior towards the end could not have been easy to deal with. And I just point out that if you're going to do this, it's very important to change my girlfriend Amanda to my wife Renata, because you could be suffering consequences much worse than just plagiarism. Okay, now, the final set of things that I was going to talk about, and don't worry, this will be my ending slide when I get to the thing, was, and you know, actually, since I'm around till Friday, anybody who really wants to see it can do it. We can do that. You know, I've characterized articles according to how much interest they generate from the general public. So this is Michael Faraday, and this is my metaphor for communicating science to the general public. And we see those easily in the activity logs because, you know, if an article gets 100,000 readers, we know, you know, a good article gets 500 to 1,000 readers because those are the number of people in the community. So as soon as it's getting 100,000, we know it's being referred by the news media and we're getting the general public in. And, you know, that's a good thing. We're trying to outreach, we're trying to do outreach, we're trying to get the taxpayer engaged. And it's fun to characterize what are the kind of articles, in a positive, not a cynical way, what kind of articles attract this kind of attention. And so I won't say anything about this. This is, you know, an early slash dot effect where somebody calculated on a fixed budget, if you assume Moore's law, you're better off going to the beach for the first 3 years in graduate school, buying the most powerful computer, and then in 4 years you'll have finished the calculation faster than you would have had you just done it with by buying the computer right off. Perelman's article gets a lot of attention. Einstein is wrong sort of thing gets a lot of attention. You know, this was picked up by the news media. I didn't mention that, you know, we know where these people are coming from via the referral log. One of the fun things over time is to see the way the public media is changing, whereas 6 or 7 years ago it was Reddit and Digg, now the dominant referrers from the social media, of course, Facebook and Twitter. And there's very interesting dynamics in the interplay between blog space and news space and the social media that I won't have time to talk about. So this, of course, was the famous superluminal neutrinos. And speaking of causality violation, I don't read German, but I'm told this is meaningful. An überlicht Geschwindigkeit has the over light speed sort of feel to it. Okay, I was going to say something. You know, this was to set this up. This was an article by some of my colleagues, down, including the one I did the segmentation article with. They did this article about, you know, a perfectly legitimate epidemiology article using real geographic data to, you know, in one of these susceptible type statistical mechanical models. But they put zombies, you know, they gave it a zombie theme, and in a good way that attracted plenty of attention. And I just put together some of the themes that picked up. But the one I wanted to get to and to close out on, as long as I know, let's just say something. You know, one of them is, of course, Interstellar, got a lot of attention, various forms of news media. I guess I can use this. There's some real science in there. There's a lot of machine learning. Turns out to be very, very popular in the computer science sector. You know, there's Tatooine, the double stars, external planets are extremely popular. There's some real physics that gets a lot of attention, which is quite nice. And then there's things like, let's see if I can get to it. April 1st turns out always to generate and I had a historical antecedent. So a farewell to falsifiability gets, you know, a few tens of thousands of readers. Actually, maybe somebody in string theory can tell me if this is an April Fool's joke or not. Sometimes it's hard to tell. They want to dispense with other outdated F words and quote a lot of famous people who support it. So, you know, here's the historical antecedent. It's long been a, I promised some of the people in this audience. So I would say they got the top quark mass right, but they really blew it on the Higgs. So finally, I wanted to get to, you know, why I mentioned that I was, why that article about the word occurrences occurred late, and this will be my last one, but also has some interesting sociological content. In February, this article jointly by Bicep2 and Keck appeared showing that the polarization that Bicep2 had announced in March was a real polarization, but was entirely just coming from the background dust. And so after I had was so proud of myself on a one-hour turnaround doing that linear regression and producing that plot, I was at an InfoSci faculty meeting on a Monday lunch. I remember this very well. And I said, well, you know, I thought you were going to send me what that looked like. He said, no, we're put off for a week because of the Bicep2 results coming out. And so that was in February. And so in a regrettable moment of pure pique, I said, wait a second, this is not news. Because we've known since last spring that those polarization results were almost certainly dust. And so what I did in real time, this is the article, what I did in real time was just sitting at the faculty meeting, but tuning it out, was I made this graph, which shows the number of articles that used the word Bicep2. There were essentially none, zero prior to March of 2014. In the year since, the number of articles was well over 1,000. I mean, it was an amazing phenomenon. But what you can see is the number of articles mentioning Bicep2 is going down. This dark color I plotted simultaneously was the number of the subset of those articles that mentioned dust. And you can see very clearly coming a year in advance that in February 2015, Bicep2 was going to bite the dust. And so I sent this to him, you know, within 10 minutes with the unfortunate line, you know, so we knew this all along, and moreover, the only thing you learn from this is not to get videoed accepting a bottle of champagne. And which was very unfair because, you know, what are you supposed to do, not open the door? Anyway, so the day later, he just sent me this thing and said, you know, and with the quote, okay, do you permit this to appear? So I said yes, because I know Andre Linde has a good sense of humor, and I wasn't really worried about that. And so just another example of the kind of, you know, once you're set up to do these things, the kind of inferential sociological data. So I plan to say a number of other things, but I'll just not stop on this one. I'll leave a relevant one and entertain questions and apologize for running over.
So, questions. Okay, let me start off actually, which is I wanted to know if you've used the author clustering thing to identify your referees.
Yeah, you actually, well, you need more text than that. Usually a referee report is too, you know, the statistical thing, and that's why we're using multiple 5,000 word blocks of text. But, you know, we turn that around in one of the things I didn't mention. You know, people ask, could you make a system that suggests referees? And that's where you can use, you know, the semantic meaning of your text in order to suggest referees, you know, which has the occasional added virtue that you'll suggest as referee the person you plagiarized from. you're going to complain about the Higgs?
No. So quality, of course, is a matter of taste. But I mean, there are some papers that almost everybody agrees are really high quality. So can you do your semantic analysis to see what's a good paper and what's not an interesting paper?
No. You know, the because of the multilingual and all, you know, you can find papers that are riding trends and try to do inference on that. And you have all sorts of, and we actually had this as a task about a decade ago at the Knowledge Discovery and Data Mining Conference, of giving snapshots and asking people to use various features like author's past citation history, the readership of current articles, to develop some machine learning algorithm to predict how many citations an article would get over some period. And, you know, if you're looking for the really singularly excellent articles, you just don't find it because they, at least I haven't seen a way to find it. Yeah, that, you know, there's nothing there that you signal in the text. You can, you know, sometimes see more likely, you know, it's more likely that such a person will write such an article. But, you know, I shouldn't exaggerate too much. It's usually uninteresting in the sense that, yeah, we knew that already. And the best one is the one that you just don't see any obvious way of seeing. The graduate student who, you know, solves quantum gravity is just not going to be, you know, with no publication record or anything like that. You know, but there is something that's unbelievably predictive, which I could mention, that and this is both surprising and unsurprising as usual, based on just the first week's readership, you can, with, you know, basically greater than 98% confidence, predict the entirety of the citation distribution over the following 6 years. So, you know, that's one of these statistical regularities that, you know, there are occasional fault, you know, you can see what we call the Boy Who Cried Wolf articles, which are, you know, promising amazing things, but don't do it. They have, you know, some profile that gets lots of activity and then instantly drops to zero. And then you see the standard ones, and, you know, based on basically the exponential fall off, how much of a tail they have, you can, you know, predict how much activity they're going to get. Folded in together with, you know, the scale of the thing is the number of readers, which is the number of people working in that subject area. And so there's a lot of sociology in these areas, which has predictable dynamics, which is, you know, also interesting.
Yeah, may I ask a question related to Daniel's? How would you think of the current peer review system, which has been running for a century or more than that? Would you think it should be something really good and should just keep going, or something needs improvement, and in what aspects, or something you think would become obsolete very quickly and get replaced by more online and open, like, reviewing system?
What makes you think it's been around for a century?
Excuse me?
What makes you think it's been around for a century?
Well, I think it's been long, right? The current anonymous peer reviews has been long. No. Oh, sorry, then.
There's actually a famous story opinion of Einstein's first experience with peer review, where he wrote an article that was basically completely wrong. I mean, laughably wrong, where he said gravitational waves were just a coordinate transformation, and sent it to the Physical Review, and got back a referee report from the publisher, and he said, presumably in German, I did not send this article to you to have somebody read it. I sent it to you in order that you publish it. And, you know, never sort of thanked them for sparing him this embarrassment. But, you know, the fact is, going back to the first journals, the Proceedings of the Royal Academy in 1685, the peer review is done by an editor. You know, they call it a secretary, but it was a scientific secretary. And what we call peer review is really, you know, this mass production mode is really a post-World War II construct when you needed a scalable methodology when no one editor could just read things and approve or reject, and it had to be parceled out and sent to people. And I just mention it because, you know, people have this impression it's been around forever, but, you know, just like Cornell undergraduates think that Google has been around forever. You know, there was a prior history. Now, in direct answer to your question, I don't really have a, you know, peer review has lots of good features. We got fantastic peer review on this article I mentioned that I sent to PNAS. They forwarded to us references and found, you know, minor statistical things that greatly improved the article. And so there are occasions where peer review works very well. There are occasions where we know it doesn't work well. It's extremely expensive, I think, is the real problem with it. It's the great contributor. Not that the reviewers are paid, but the whole infrastructure to support it and support editors, and there are diseconomies of scale, like the American Physical Society. Once you have multiple editors in-house, then you need human services, IT department, you need lawyers, and so, you know, the bigger you get, the more it costs per article. And so that's the realm that I said at the outset is a talk in itself and that we can't really discuss. You know, my own guess is that in the longer run, because we now have what we didn't have in the print era, we had the ability to disseminate before applying this filter, that, you know, you could easily have post-dissemination review. And a lot of people have tried to do that with archive articles or use these so-called alternative metrics based on readership. My only real comment is that, you know, whatever form it takes, I think that most of the people in the community still believe that some form of quality control is necessary. And so if we had a system like this, you know, somebody would have to invent it because, you know, if you're reading outside of your field, you want somebody, you know, for your own field, you can make your own decision, but you're working interdisciplinary or you're a student non-expert, you want somebody to be certifying the stuff to you. And my guess is in the future, it'll be some more crowdsourced thing, but it'll require still some kind of, you know, formalized, organized control, but I don't know exactly what form it'll take or how it'll be funded. Somebody over here.
So you said you could plot this, how many times an article is read early on versus, and you could predict the total citations. You know, there's a lot of superstition that you know, one needs to post onto the archive at a certain time to get at the top of the list. Or, you know, at like certain days of the week, certain months of the year or something like that. Do you see any, like, can you use any correlations like that? You know, do we really need to be getting at the top of a readership list? Do these things matter?
Well, I actually studied that. We have an article on that. It was suggested by somebody else. I provided data. You know, there's this striking phenomenon in first noticed in AstroPH, where if you look at submissions by time of day, then, you know, there's a certain daily variation, which is just based on confluence of time zones. So late morning is the most active period Eastern time, because that's when Western Europe is still on, when the Western United States starts coming in. And then superimposed on that daily variation is this gigantic spike at 4 minutes, basically, sorry, at 1600 Eastern time, which is when the turnover is and where people are angling for this pole position. And, you know, the question was, does that work? And the answer is, you know, in fact, yes, there is some presentation bias that if you look, again, on the six-year time frame, the articles that appeared first or in the top few positions do get a statistically significant greater number of median citations 6 years later. And, you know, we had to be fairly careful to screen because there's a selection bias. Maybe, you know, what you've got if you look at the logs, you have people, you know, it's no accident because we have this local time function, which was originally intended just so people, you know, knew the hour, so they knew roughly. It was never intended to have somebody hanging out on the return key once a second trying to see what time it is, and then, you know, finally as soon as it hits 6 o'clock, you think they could synchronize once, but never mind. And, you know, then instantly put it in there. And, you know, it could be that the groups that have are large and have a graduate student to assign to this task are large because they already have funding. They have funding because they already have, you know, lots of citations to their past articles. So it may just be a selection bias. But, you know, for the period in question, we were able to use articles that were just submitted in the middle of the day that happened to have been moved to the front position and see there were enough of those that we could get statistically significant results and find that they got about 30% more median citations than they would have gotten had they been left there. You know, on the other hand, there are plenty of the biggest distortion in this graph was one of the WMAP articles. They jumped the gun and got it in 1 second early, so they were the last article on some days, and, you know, that's the most heavily retrieved last article there ever was. And so the lesson from that is, you know, for some articles, it's just not going to make a difference why they thought it was important. You know, it's just kind of overkill. So there are various forms of presentation biases. But we didn't ask the question, I guess it's sort of interesting, of, you know, what phase of the year. I mean, the impression is you'll get less attention if, you know, you submit between Christmas and New Year's. You know, if you think about what's happening, it's some kind of preferential attachment effect where there are multiple articles that are to first degree fungible, and just one of them early on becomes the standard one that people refer to. So there's this slight distortion, and it's like a snowball. And after 6 years, that one, because of that slight initial perturbation, has, you know, collected that much more activity. And so you could imagine the same thing happening. But, you know, it's not true. You have to be careful because it's not true across the board. One of the most fun counterexamples was in high energy theory, where there's almost the opposite effect, that the articles that appear at the end of the day have almost just as much a boost, the ones that are at the end of the listings. And, you know, why would that might be? We could call that the procrastinator effect. How many of you are well before deadlines? I mean, not me. I was very proud of myself when I managed to get my Aspen application in 10 minutes before the deadline, you know, midnight, January 31st. And so the busiest people, the most active, are the ones that, you know, are just have so many other things to do, and they finally get it towards the end of the day. Another effect is the people who want to stake the precedence claim, they're more concerned about their competition coming up with an article. So more important than being first is just to get it out there and have that, you know, one day precedence claim. And so in some fields, particularly HEPTH, that turns out to be most important. One correlation that we found, which I can, you know, leave as some form of lesson, is there was also the fewest citations are the people who are entirely oblivious to deadlines. So if you're just randomly in there in the middle of the day, those articles tend to get the fewest citations. And we screened, you know, for geographic effects. It could be that, you know, that was because it was time zones coming from places where those countries are ones that are correlated with fewer citations. But we, you know, cross-correlated that with just the ones from Western Europe, the United States, and, you know, found. So if you're the kind of person that has nothing better to do than submit an article at 10 o'clock, it's not like 10 a.m. Eastern time, you're not likely to get a lot of citations. And, you know, once again, it's correlation, not causation. It's not like if you submit it, you know, pretend that you're very busy and submit it just before the deadline, that will magically generate citations for you.
Maybe one more question? Okay, if not, then let's thank Paul again.